Tantoradio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The World According to Proust by Joshua Landy, narrated by Stephen Bowlby. Publisher's Note: In this audio edition, you will hear references to photos present in the print and e-book formats of the book. Preface: Marcel Proust may well be France's best-known literary writer. He lived only 51 years, from 1871 to 1922, but managed in that short span to write stories, essays, translations, and a 3,000-page, seven-volume book, In Search of Lost Time, 1913 to 27, that some people have called the world's greatest novel. Those people may include me. It took him 13 years, and he died before being able to revise some of the later volumes, with the result that a dead character will occasionally come back to life, but it is finished enough to count as one of the all-time masterpieces of European literature. Proust's writing has had an impact not only on literature, but also on thought. In their very different ways, philosophers Walter Benjamin, Gilles Deleuze, Maurice Merleau-Ponty, Derek Parfit, and Paul Ricoeur all drew inspiration from him. So did theorists of narrative, like Gérard Janet. Empirical psychologists have done studies on the phenomenon of involuntary memory, and it's rare to see such a study that does not cite Proust. A 2013 paper titled Involuntary Autobiographical Memories by Rosemary Bradley et al. Has a large picture of Madeleines and tea at the top. When Virginia Woolf read The Search, she wrote to Roger Fry asking, what remains to be written after that? Samuel Beckett, Anais Nin, Carlos Fuentes, Harold Pinter, James Merrill, and Anne Carson were all influenced by Proust. So were filmmakers like Jean-Luc Godard, Chris Marker, Luchino Visconti, and, arguably, Alfred Hitchcock. There are films based on Proust's novel, as well as a French TV adaptation that is surprisingly good. There's also a graphic novel version that is sublime. In 2019, a fan embarked on an out loud reading of the entire novel, in French, in San Francisco subway stations. People keep writing more and more biographies of Proust, many of them very long. Monty Python hilariously imagined a summarized Proust competition. In Wes Anderson's The Life Aquatic, Cate Blanchett reads Proust to her unborn child. And the 2006 comedy, Little Miss Sunshine, features Steve Carell as the number one Proust scholar in the United States. Yes, my friends do ask me, and no, I wish. Proust shows up not just in philosophy books and in psychology studies, but also in popular films such as Little Miss Sunshine. The scene pictured in the print version of the book goes over particularly well with fans of Proust, thanks to this memorable bit of dialogue. Frank, Steve Carell. Larry Sugarman is perhaps the second most highly regarded Proust scholar in the U.S. Rich, Greg Kinnear. Who's number one? Frank. That would be me, Rich. There is excellent reason for all of this interest. Part of it has to do with a revolution in style Proust undertook. Everything infinitely long, infinitely complex, and yet also carefully organized. And part of it has to do with a series of brilliant observations and difficult questions raised by his writing. How can we feel at home in the world? How can we find genuine connection with other human beings? How can we find enchantment in a world without God? How art can transform our lives? Whether an artist's life can shed light on her work? What we can know about the world, other people, and ourselves, when not knowing is better than knowing. How sexual orientation affects questions of connection and identity. Who we really are, deep down. What memory tells us about our inner world. Why it might be good to think of our life as a story. How we can feel like a single, unified person when we are torn apart by competing desires and change over time. And why it matters to read Proust's writing itself, not just this book, even if I don't do a terrible job. That's quite a lot to talk about in 100-odd pages, and unfortunately I won't get to all kinds of other things I love in Proust, the character Françoise and her fascinating way of speaking, modern technology, habit, etymology, symbolic geography, metaphysics, metonymic metaphor, the magic of names, the complicated relationship to Henri Bergson, the partial love of discontinuity. But the themes in the previous paragraph are the kind Proust focused on when he discussed his book, so it doesn't seem totally unfair for a short, very short, introduction to focus on those. From time to time, I'll refer to Proust's articles, his letters, an interview he gave, and the prefaces he wrote to his translations of Ruskin. They help us see that Proust agrees with his narrator-protagonist on some things, even if he disagrees with him on others. But I won't have much to say about the short stories, the pastiches, or the abandoned early manuscript, published posthumously as Jean Santoya, even though there is some lovely stuff in each. When people say, "I'm reading Proust," they usually mean, "I'm reading that 3,000-page novel that had better be the masterpiece you promised me it was." I think they're right. And I think it is. Chapter 1. Art and Life. A book like this would normally start with a few pages of biography. It would tell you who Proust's parents were, where he was born, who he dated, what he ate for breakfast, and all kinds of other juicy information. There is some juicy information here and there. André Gide took a pass on publishing Swan's Way when it was offered to him, and Proust had the last laugh by winning the Goncourt Prize in 1919. But there isn't that much of it, and in any case, with apologies to anyone who wanted to hear more of that kind of thing, it isn't what I'm going to focus on. That's partly because biographical information is so readily available online, as well as in some wonderful books, and partly because there's so much else to talk about. But it's mainly because Proust would have disapproved, and I just couldn't look at myself in the mirror if I didn't. What I'd rather do instead is explain why Proust would have disapproved. Because, fascinatingly enough, this disapproval ended up generating part of his literary masterpiece, In Search of Lost Time. Why you shouldn't want a biography. Proust was reacting against one of the most prominent critics of the 19th century, Charles-Augustin Sainte-Beuve. When Sainte-Beuve wrote about the novelists of his age, he didn't just analyze and assess their books, he also talked about what they were like as dinner companions. That, Proust thought, is why Sainte-Beuve ended up getting it wrong about giants like Balzac, Stendhal, Nerval, Flaubert, and Manet. Sainte-Beuve's mistake? Explaining the true Fantin or Manet, the one that is only found in their work, on the basis of the mortal man. Proust's conclusion was simple but important. It doesn't matter whether a writer is good or bad company. You can be a brilliant artist and a lousy talker, or a dauber with a gift of the gab. You can make great art, but not fully understand what you've accomplished. That's what Proust thought about the painter Chardin. Or even get it wrong about what you've accomplished. That's what Proust's narrator thinks about the playwright Molière. You can be an unfaithful spouse who writes moralizing fiction, or a faithful spouse who writes libertine fiction. That's what Proust's narrator thinks about Madame de Genlis and Chaudelot du Laclos, respectively. So, what we know about an author's life tells us next to nothing about her novels. In fact, as a famous line in an early Proust manuscript puts it, a book is the product of a different self from the self we manifest in our habits, in our social life, in our vices. This idea is beautifully illustrated in The Search, where all three of the great fictional artists, Vinteuil, the composer, Bergotte, the novelist, Elstir, the painter, are flawed as people, but the prudish respectability of the one, Vinteuil, the intolerable defects of the other, Bergotte, even the pretentious vulgarity of an Elstir in his early days, prove nothing against them. Their genius is manifested in their works. The same is true even for doctors like Cotard, and we realize that this imbecile was a great physician. In fact, Proust's own life story is disappointingly lackluster. Arguably the best reason to read it is that it is such great evidence for his own view. Proust the novelist is vastly more interesting than Proust the person, and that it helps us appreciate the amazing alchemy of art. As Proust scholar Malcolm Bowie said, that a life like that should have produced a novel like this is the miracle of miracles. There's something else that follows from Proust's anti-Sainte-Beuvian stance, but that's something I hesitate to mention in case you happen to have gone to see Proust's bedroom in the Musée Carnavalet or visited the town of Illiers in north-central France. Some years ago, Illiers rebranded itself Illiers-Cambrai, marketing itself as the town prominently featured in Proust's novel. Proust's protagonist used to spend holidays in Cambrai as a child, visiting his aunt Léonie, eating madeleines on a Sunday, taking walks near Charles Swann's house or by the Guermont estate, and so on. But that's Proust's protagonist, a fictional character, and not Proust. Cambrai isn't a real town. Proust didn't have an Aunt Léonie, and Proust almost certainly didn't eat a madeleine that brought back his childhood. So it's a bit odd that you can now visit Cambrai and visit the Maison de Tante Léonie. Proust would not have liked this. He would have called it idolatry. Idolatry is a word Proust uses in the preface to La Bible d'Omion, his translation of a book by John Ruskin. Here, Proust raises an eyebrow at people who get excited on seeing a dress that's exactly like one worn by a Balzac heroine, or insist on visiting a house Balzac lived in. Once stripped of the spirit that is in it, Proust writes, the dress is no more than a sign deprived of its meaning. That is to say, nothing. And to keep on adoring it so much as to be enraptured upon encountering it in real life on a woman's body is, properly speaking, idolatry. If worshipping physical objects in the place of God, the true object of veneration, is religious idolatry, then fetishizing dresses and houses in place of novels, the true object of veneration, is aesthetic idolatry. So while it's entirely understandable in a way that fans of Proust eat up biographies, Sainte-Beuvism, and make pilgrimages to so-called Cambrai, idolatry, I fear it all makes Proust turn in his grave in Père Lachaise. Don't go there either, by the way. To be fair, we probably don't make Proust turn too much in that grave of his if we visit him, his bed, or his favorite towns in the right frame of mind. It's fine to go out of curiosity, to pay homage to the great writer that he was, or even to take snarky photos of the Maison de Tante Léonie, as I myself may possibly have done. We just need to remember that Aunt Léonie wasn't a real person, that Proust probably never ate a magic madeleine that restored his memories of Illiers, that there's nothing intrinsically special about the seaside town Cabourg, and above all that, none of what we see in these places explains in the slightest how the astonishing novel came into being. Why Proust's novel isn't one either. For Proust, then, the everyday self is entirely different from the writing self, also known as the true self. You're quite simply a different person when you make art from when you move around and interact with other people. And that means there's no inference that can be legitimately drawn from your biography to an assessment of your work. In fact, it can be harmful to your work if people know about your life, since they'll be tempted to read all kinds of things into it that aren't really there. This actually applies quite nicely to Proust's own novel, which many readers have taken to be a lightly fictionalized autobiography. In a way, that assumption is understandable, given that Proust is writing in the first person, that he draws on his own experience for a number of the scenes, and that there are two moments in which the character seems to be called Marcel. Still, Some believe that if Proust had lived long enough, he would have edited out at least one of those Marcels, just as he had deleted the occasional stray Marcel in previous volumes. And the other of those Marcels belongs to one of the all-time great and dizzying sentences in world literature. Then she would find her tongue and say, "My," or "My darling," followed by my Christian name, which, if we give the narrator the same name as the author of this book, would be "My Marcel," or "My darling Marcel." Isn't that fantastic? Far from saying the character's name is Marcel, this mind-bending sentence only says it would be Marcel if it were the same name as the author's. If Proust's novel were really an autobiography, the question wouldn't even arise. Proust himself frequently said to anyone who would listen that the character isn't him, or at least isn't entirely him. For example, in an interview published in 1913, right before the first volume came out, Proust spoke of the character who narrates, who says, "I," and who is not me. As it happens, there are some highly significant differences between the two. Not only did Proust, most likely, never eat a madeleine that brought back lost memories, he also never visited a town named Balbec, never met anyone named Guillaumont, and never heard a septet by a composer named Vinteuil. We'll hear more about Balbec, Vinteuil, and the madeleine in due course. Meanwhile, Proust had a brother. The narrator is an only child. Proust's mother was Jewish. The narrator is all Catholic. And his maternal grandfather is even mildly anti-Semitic. Proust was gay. The narrator is straight. So straight, in fact, that same-sex desire seems to baffle him. More on that in Chapter 4. Some readers have reacted to the difference in sexual orientation by claiming that the character's love interests, Gilbert Swann, Albertine Simonet, the Duchesse de Guillemont, Alex de Stiamaria, are really men in disguise. That hypothesis is not entirely absurd, since Gide reported Proust as saying he had transposed some same-sex experiences onto female characters. Gilbert and Albertine look like men's names with feminine endings, and one or two other small things point in that direction. But a number of features mark Albertine as female, from her physicality, whose difference from his own delights the narrator, to the social taboo around cohabitation, which would not be the case for another man, and the fact that she ultimately tries to coerce the narrator into marriage, gay marriage hardly being a realistic plan, to put it mildly, in the early 20th century. Above all, though, turning the women into men would eliminate lesbianism, and lesbianism, along with bisexuality, is vitally important in the novel, where it dramatizes the difficulty of fully understanding another person. This is an argument made by Elizabeth Laidenson in her brilliant and indispensable book, Proust's Lesbianism. The narrator's desperate struggles to project himself into Albertine's mind, to see the world from her point of view, only reveal to him the curtain that is forever lowered for other people over what happens in the mysterious intimacy of every human creature. The fact that her sexual life is something he cannot even begin to imagine makes this problem cognitively sharp, emotionally powerful, and existentially meaningful. So, we should almost certainly keep the female characters female. Even when we do, fortunately, Proust's novel remains one that is deeply interested in male same-sex desire. The single longest sentence in the novel is a lament for the situation of persecuted gay men like Oscar Wilde. But with the women as women, it also preserves an interest in female same-sex desire, as well as in stark versions of the problem of other minds. When it comes to Proust's novel, then, reading it as an autobiography makes it a less interesting book. It draws on a life, but its purpose isn't just to retell it. It's to turn those raw materials, together with elements of pure invention, into a stunning work of philosophical fiction, making it something that can have a powerful and lasting effect on each and every one of us. We're about to see why that is. Chapter 2. Plot and Character. It's notoriously hard to boil Proust's 3,000-page novel down to a short synopsis. That's why Monty Python's All England Summarized Proust competition is so hilarious. At the risk of unintentional comedy, I'll try to give a general sense by focusing on a few central strands. There will be spoilers, but there won't, I hope, be typos. Let's see how I do on the Proustometer. My entry for the Summarized Proust competition. The main thing to know is that, in spite of the title, this book isn't actually a search for lost time. Yes, the narrator does remember things, and remembering is important, but he's never really looking for memory. He also doesn't spend a lot of time saying how sad he is that he's forgotten things. Nor are forgotten memories something you can really search for, since they tend to return unbidden. And above all, as we'll see in a moment, the memories themselves are not what truly matters. So what does the narrator go after? Well, he tries, successfully, to enter high society, making increasingly powerful connections with the high-born Guermont family. He strives, less successfully, for intimate connection via friendship and love. He spends time with amiable aristocrat Robert de Saint-Loup, has a childhood crush on Gilberte Swann, daughter of family friend Charles Swann, obsesses over the Duchesse de Guermont, and has a relatively long relationship, troubled by pathological jealousy, with Albertine Simonet. He also lingers in nature, seeking to decipher the secret language of hawthorns and trees. He visits Baalbek, a seaside town in Normandy, and Venice, hoping each time for a transformative change of environment. In quest of aesthetic satisfaction, he reads books by a novelist called Bergotte, admires canvases by a painter called Elstir, and listens to melodies by a composer called Vantoya. And he struggles to produce a novel of his own, battling a case of writer's block that lasts for decades. None of these things brings him lasting happiness. The time he spends around paintings, novels, and septets is exhilarating, but transitory. When it comes to high society, friendship, and love, he loses hope of finding something meaningful in any of them. He gives up, too, on being inspired by travel and nature, and above all, on becoming a writer. As far as he can tell, he simply has no talent for it. His health, too, goes into increased decline, and he spends long years in a sanatorium that doesn't do much good, followed by a long time in a different sanatorium that doesn't do much good either, being no more successful in curing me than the first. For those interested in keeping track of chronology, the opening line, "For a long time I used to go to bed early," refers to this point in time, the character's middle age, and not to childhood. Childhood is, by now, a distant memory. There's one ray of light in this otherwise gloomy period. After he eats a madeleine dipped in tea, something he hasn't done in many years, a powerful feeling of euphoria suddenly washes over him, followed by a flood of forgotten childhood memories. We'll hear more about that in Chapter 3. But the euphoria is short-lived. When we see him on his way to a high society party in the final volume, having returned from the second sanatorium, he is resigned to a life of superficiality. If he can't become a writer, he may as well waste his time with the snobs. Albertine is long dead. Robert de Saint-Loup has been killed in battle. Méséglise, home to the Swans, has been destroyed in the war. It seems the race is lost. But, while waiting to be admitted to the party, the narrator experiences a series of Madeleine-style memories, all in a row. And this time, he manages to figure out what such experiences mean, why they confer such bliss. The ensuing train of thought ends up solving the problems that have kept him from his vocation, and by the end, he's begun work on a novel, one that may or may not be the novel we've just read. Want to know what I think? See the postscript. He has found, amazingly, what he was searching for all along. Finding identity, connection, and belonging. We're almost done with the summarized Proust section of this book, but not quite. The central plot of Proust's novel is indeed about the discovery of a vocation, the narrator becoming a writer, finding a reason for being, finally becoming able to live a meaningful and valuable life. But there's more to it than just that. His quest is also for identity, connection, and belonging. Identity. After spending years fretting about how difficult it is to know oneself, and how difficult it is to even be a self in the first place, he now has a pretty clear sense of who he is, of what makes him special, sometimes in a good way, sometimes not so much, and of how the episodes in his life can form a single story instead of reducing him to a heap of fragments. More about this in Chapter 9. Connection. Like many of us, he longs for a meeting of minds, an encounter where you see another person for who they really are, maybe even fusing with them for a moment, seeing the world thrillingly through a different pair of eyes. But, unlike many of us, he doesn't find this in friendship or in love, and it's art that, surprisingly, will ride to his eventual rescue. More on that in Chapter 7. Belonging. Here, the question is how we can feel at home in the world, given that almost nothing we encounter is there for our benefit, and indeed, much of it positively resists us. One central example in the novel is a first night in an unfamiliar hotel room where the narrator has a really tough time adjusting to his new surroundings, surroundings that are completely indifferent to him as an individual. The obvious solution, of course, is simply to get used to things. Over time, you stop noticing the insolent indifference of the clock, the strange and pitiless mirror, and the hostility of the violet curtains. But habit is a two-edged sword. It may increase your comfort level, but it does so by placing a barrier between you and the world, preventing you from making authentic contact with what's really there. So, how can you genuinely experience reality while still feeling at home within it? How can you find comfort, a sense of fit between you and everything around you, without walling yourself off in fantasy land? In Proust's novel, a fascinating answer is available between the lines. That answer? Make art. Imagine your closest friends sitting in a circle around a bowl of flowers, all doing their best to paint a picture of it. Each of these paintings is going to turn out slightly different because each of them is going to bear the mark of its creator. Yet each of them is presumably going to feature flowers. So these paintings will make contact with reality while, at the same time, reflecting the unique qualities of your friends. The flowers become their flowers, imprinted with their subjectivity. It is their personal style, but with the world's objects still visible beneath. That's how art can tame the world, bringing it under your spell, making it conform to your special way of seeing. That's how it can allow you to feel at home. We saw a moment ago that the narrator solves the connection problem by experiencing the art of others. Now we can add that he solves the belonging problem by making art of his own. High society, travel, and friendship haven't done much for him at all. Love and nature have inadvertently shown a clarifying light on his character, but they haven't delivered the connection and enchantment he was hoping for. What really transforms his life is art. Thanks to the magic of individual style, art is the place where we can enter most deeply into the soul of another person, and also where self and world meet and shake hands, where each of us can finally find ourselves in harmony with the cosmos. Reenchanting the world. So the narrator ends up not just with a vocation, a meaningful purpose, a reason for living, but also with identity, connection, and belonging. He has a self he can point to, a conduit he can use to other minds, and a world he can feel at home in. All that is true, but there's something else he achieves.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?